Welcome back to the Extension Experience Podcast. I'm Dana Zook. This episode is part of a series we are partnering with the College of Veterinary Medicine at Oklahoma State University. With spring in our midst, internal parasite management is at the top of mind for many beef producers. So here to talk with me about deworming management and a project they are working on is Dr. John Gillum. Welcome, Dr. Gillum.
Thank you.
Dr. Gillum is a large animal veterinarian and clinical professor in food animal production, medicine, and field service with the OSU College of Veterinary Medicine. So long title, but you're very busy. So Dr. Gillum, tell us a little bit about yourself since this is the first time on the podcast.
Yeah, I am a native Oklahoman, grew up in a little town called Macomb, Oklahoma, about an hour and a half south of Stillwater here. Came to Oklahoma State longer ago than I care to remember to do undergrad and went to veterinary school here as well. After we graduated, my wife's a veterinarian as well, and we both practiced in the Texas Panhandle for a few years, and then we've been back here at OSU since 2003 in varying capacities. And yeah, my primary role is field service and production medicine for food animals, primarily cattle, and then just some kind of filling in the hospital here when help is needed and doing various things.
So your part of your job really is, I mean, like you said, if producers need some assistance or rural veterinarians need some assistance, you will make those calls sometimes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Most of my job is with producers.
Right.
In the clinic, we deal with referring veterinarians quite a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
But for my field service work, it's mostly with producers. And so that ranges from anything from individual sick animal work to production work, anything that anybody needs.
Yeah.
Traditional on-farm veterinary practice.
You've come out to kind of my area of the state several times for kind of a question about what's going on. These cattle have some respiratory problems.
Right.
We don't really know what's going on. And so you've helped them through a lot of things.
Yeah, most of our work is local, mm-hmm. kind of local practice stuff here close to Stillwater, but we do travel and do some disease investigations around the state if clients are interested and have a need for that. Yeah.
Lots of different things.
Lots of things.
Yeah, lots of cool stuff. So today we're going to talk about parasites.
Sure.
Dr. Gillum, parasites are reality, like we all know. I think I've talked more about parasites in the last couple weeks than I have in a long time, but we are in that spring season. Specifically, we're not going to talk about parasites in beef cattle, internal parasites. So external parasites, in my opinion, are more apparent to producers, maybe on the outside because we can see them.
Right.
But internal parasites are kind of an out of sight, out of mind thing sometimes. Why is this, and maybe is this the reason that we have kind of trouble identifying what parasites we need to control internally?
Well, so the part of the challenge is we don't see a lot of outward clinical signs in animals anymore. It used to be more common many years ago, but we've been in a period of time for the last several decades, honestly, where we've had multiple very effective anthelmintic products. And so we've gotten into a habit as an industry of just using those products in every animal once or two or three times a year. And so we really haven't seen very little clinical parasitism for a very long time. And that's kind of how we've gotten to where we are now with concerns about the efficacy of those products. But
mm-hmm.
but when we just say, well, we just schedule, we're going to deworm everybody, this time and that time. And we do that, and up until now, the products have all been very effective. And so mm-hmm. we don't see much production loss or for certainly any clinical signs in the animals for the most part. And so they just kind of become kind of out of sight, out of mind, because if we're using those products as part of our routine herd health management, then we're not seeing, we don't really realize the parasites are there because we've been keeping them controlled pretty well.
Because of that, we're seeing maybe some potential issues with resistance to those drugs, right? And we'll talk about that here
correct.
In a little bit. So before we do that, let's get a baseline for kind of the life cycle of worms and internal parasites in cattle and kind of how cattle pick them up.
So the way those cattle pick those parasites up, those parasites are on the pasture in a larval stage. They pick them up while they're grazing. The parasites are usually the little larvae. They're microscopic. You can't see them without a microscope. But they're usually associated with moisture droplets on plants. And they're usually within about 6 inches or so of the ground surface. They don't move very high up the plant. But then as the cattle are out there grazing, they just pick those up, as they're grazing. Then those parasites go through a couple of more developmental stages in the animal. And then they become an adult parasite. And then they start producing eggs. And those eggs are shed in the cattle feces. They hatch in the feces. There's about 5 larval stages that they go through, and then those larvae live in the fecal pat. Then they move out onto the grass as they continue to go through their developmental stages, and they're there, and cattle come along, pick them up again, and it's just a repetitive cycle.
Yeah, just a big
circle.
It takes
about, for most of our common cattle parasites, it's about a 21-day life cycle.
Okay.
From the time the egg is laid until it's a egg-producing adult in an animal, assuming it gets picked up right away.
So very quickly.
Pretty quickly. Pretty quick generation interval, yeah.
And so that's why we could have several, many generations within a season, a growing season.
Yeah.
And they're pretty, these little internal parasites are pretty robust, right? So they can kind of go, is dormant the word?
They can, yeah. So they can live on the pasture for quite a long time if conditions are favorable to them. We don't really get cold enough here in Oklahoma to really have a great winter kill of parasites. It'll kill some, but it doesn't eliminate them. Some of our summers can be pretty hard on them if it gets really hot and really dry, but if we stay relatively cool and we have some moisture, they're pretty hardy and they'll be out there on the pasture. And it'll certainly, you know, weather conditions will impact their numbers, but it doesn't typically eliminate them from the pasture.
Okay.
They can also become dormant in the animal. And nobody really knows how they know this, but they have a ability to sense if the external conditions are unfavorable to their survival, they can become dormant in the animal and stay in the animal until external conditions become more favorable for their survival. So it's called hypobiosis. And,
okay.
And we don't really know how they know what the outside world is like when they're living in the abomasum of a cow, but somehow they have a way to know that. And so that creates another challenge for their control.
Crazy.
Yeah, pretty neat.
They're pretty smart, unfortunately.
Right.
So what are can you give us a simple list of some of the main internal parasites that we're dealing with?
Yeah, the biggest one in cattle is called Ostertagia.
Okay.
Or the brown stomach worm. It is a parasite that's very small, attaches to primarily the abomasal lining, causes some inflammation, some inflammatory changes in the stomach, but its main thing is it just absorbs nutrients that the animal is then not able to absorb. Another one called Homoncus will be a really familiar one to small ruminant producers. It's the primary small ruminant parasite, and it is a blood feeding parasite. So it attaches to the abomasum and then actually sucks blood from the animal. And so that's the main thing. It causes anemia and actually can cause death from just blood loss.
And that why we can do the look at the mucous membranes and see that in ruminants?
Yeah, that's why in small ruminants we can look for anemia based on the color of the inside of their eyelids and get an idea of which ones are heavily parasitized or not. Homoncus gets in cattle too, and occasionally we'll see clinical disease from that, but most of the time it's a minor parasite in cattle.
And so that's why we can't see that with the Ostertagia. We can't look at their mucus.
Yeah. Ostertagia is not a blood feeding parasite. And so
okay.
It doesn't create that anemia that's easy to recognize clinically.
Okay. Okay.
Couperia is another common one. It is kind of fairly similar to Ostertagia, mostly a problem in young animals. Adult cattle tend to develop immunity to it as they age, and so we don't see a lot of couperia in adult animals, but it's a very common parasite in young growing cattle.
Okay.
And then there's a handful of others that are much more minor, but those are the big ones that are most concerned from an economic and production standpoint.
What about liver flukes? How often do we see those in Oklahoma? I hear people talk about them, but I haven't really dealt with them. And do you consider them an internal parasite?
Flukes are an internal parasite. They're a little bit unusual because they're more geographically isolated.
Okay.
And that's because of their life cycle. Their life cycle involves a particular kind of snail. And the fluke, immature flukes live in the snail. And then the cattle actually ingest the snails while they're grazing in wet areas. And then that's how they get the flukes.
Okay.
And so if you're in an area where those snails are present, then liver flukes can be a problem.
Okay.
If you're in an area where you don't have those snails, then it's not much of an issue. So for Oklahoma, traditionally Oklahoma, southern Oklahoma, southeastern Oklahoma, liver flukes have been an issue. We don't typically see liver flukes here in north central Oklahoma. And if you go out to your area out west, they're really not an issue. We have in the last couple of years diagnosed some native cattle with liver flukes. And so they might be kind of moving this direction. We're not sure yet, but typically, they're a problem more south and east in Oklahoma.
Need kind of a wetter environment,
Yeah, wetter environment.
I get questions about that, and I always know that you have to have a snail
right.
to do that. So I thought that would be good to throw that out there.
If you're out in the panhandle, you're probably not going to have flukes.
No.
Unless they're cattle that have come from somewhere else.
Now, right.
Like stocker cattle, feedlot cattle, if they came from somewhere with flukes, they could arrive with issue, but they're not, native cattle aren't going to be picking up flukes typically in those drier climates.
Okay, that's good information. So like you said, we may not apparently see the symptoms of internal parasites if they're kind of at a low level.
Right.
If we do have some high infestations, what are some of those symptoms that producers might see? Because I know people look at cattle and they say they look wormy, but they may not be necessarily.
Right.
So, I mean, it's hard, but go ahead and tell us a little bit about those symptoms.
So the most common things that we'll see are diarrhea, weight loss, like kind of a rough, dull hair coat. And then if they get really severe, they'll get actually what we call bottle jaw. And that's edema or a fluid accumulation under the skin, typically under their jaw, maybe down into the brisket. And that's because those parasites consume a lot of protein. And as animals lose protein in their blood, then it allows the fluid component of the blood to leak out of the vessels. And so they get fluid accumulation under the skin. And what you'll see is a swelling under their jaw that's kind of soft and squishy when you feel of it. It takes a pretty severe disease to cause that, to get to that point. So the more important problems to say with parasitism is production loss. Reduced growth performance in young calves, potentially reduced milk production in mature cows, more of those kinds of things. Clinical disease takes a much heavier parasite load, and we don't see that very often now. It is still possible, but it's just not a common presentation.
Right.
And if a producer is seeing those signs, they've got a significant problem going on. And they've been experiencing production loss long before they got to that point of having clinical disease.
So like you said, the common description of a wormy cow may not hold necessarily true.
Correct.
You might have, and what I've seen in our project, which we'll talk about here in a little bit, very sleek, beautiful, black, fat Angus cow that is contributing to most of the worm load in the whole herd, whether that's significant or not. But I have noticed that it isn't always the one you expect.
That's correct. Yeah, there's lots of things that can make an animal be thin, have a poor hair coat. Those signs are not specific to parasites.
How should producers maybe change their way of thinking of managing these types of parasites? From your perspective as a veterinarian, how does this need to evolve a little bit?
Yeah, so we've talked a long time about strategic deworming protocols. And those are where we time our anthelmintic product administration to where we get the most value out of it based on the parasite life cycle, not based on our calendar or when we're happening to be working cows. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, we've dewormed cows when they're in the chute for whatever other purpose. And the timing may not always make sense from a parasite life cycle standpoint. I just was talking to a client just the other day. They were going to deworm cows, and we talked about it's too early right now. So if we're going to think about doing it strategically, we want to wait until cattle have been in the spring grazing for about 6 weeks before we think about deworming them, because adult cattle develop immunity over time to parasites. That parasite life cycle from the time we said it was 21 days earlier, that is the case in young animals, but in adults it tends to be more like 6 weeks. Because the immune response of the animal suppresses that life cycle and makes it longer. If a cow is relatively unparasitized through the winter, she's gonna start picking up parasites off the pasture in the spring. Those parasites aren't gonna start shedding eggs until about 6 weeks after she started grazing.
Right.
And so that's kind of the ideal time to time our deworming, is about 6 weeks after the onset of grazing green grass. And then it kind of depends on weather as to whether we do it again. In some environments, you know, a really wet, warm environment, we may need to do it again midsummer. So it just kind of depends on the environment. So there's really no kind of cookie cutter, one size fits all program. And so the best thing producers could do is work closely with their local veterinarian that's familiar with their environment and their area and develop a protocol that's based on that environment and that area. And it may change from year to year. You know, if you get into a hot, dry summer, we may need to not administer a product when we would typically do that. And if products are expensive, and there's no point administering them if we're not going to get value out of them. Mm-hmm. And so being flexible and trying to use the most information available to make the best decisions about when we apply those products is the best way to go about doing it. So we really need to move away from the blanket use of those products and be more strategic with it. And now I think as we're learning more and more about resistance, we may need to start thinking even more about testing prior to administering products and trying to get some assessment of what the parasite load in the animals is before we just go out and blanket deworm everybody.
Right.
Because what we're seeing in this data that we're generating now is that a lot of our particularly mature cow herds have very low parasite levels. And so administering an expensive anthelmintic product to those cattle isn't going to be of much benefit from a production standpoint. It's a big expense, and it's also potentially contributing to the resistance issue. And so we need to start factoring in all of those things. And so we're in a time where we need to be changing the way we think about parasite management and moving away from just the blanket use of dewormers and moving to a more, at least a strategic application. But I think even now we need to be thinking about maybe we don't need to deworm everybody every year, and maybe we need to start testing animals and see what their parasite levels are before we, particularly adult cattle. Or maybe even thinking about, you know, if you're in the Panhandle or Northwest Oklahoma and it's a really dry year, you may not need dewormers that year.
Right.
And so like, instead of just following the same protocol every year, regardless, be more strategic with how we use those products based on what we know about our herd, based on current environmental conditions, those types of things.
I like that term, strategic deworming. I think producers would be very happy to say, I don't have to spend $500 on that deworming product this year, right? If we think about it a little bit like that. So you transitioned excellently into talking about resistance. So you've mentioned a little bit about it. Explain to us how parasites develop resistance, and maybe a little bit about the term of refugia.
So parasites, we're talking about, you know, hundreds of potential, maybe hundreds of thousands of worms in an animal or in a population of animals. Some of those worms have either a genetic mutation or are just lucky and are able to survive when exposed to an anthelminid product. We know our products typically do not kill 100% of the parasites that are in an animal. And even if a small percentage of those parasites survive because they have a mutation that allows them to be resistant to that product, we're not going to recognize that in that animal. But over time, as we use that product more and more and more, those resistant parasites become a larger percentage of the parasite population. And so, because if we go in and we deworm an animal and we kill the parasites that are there, all the susceptible ones, then it's only the resistant ones that are left shedding eggs on the environment. Not a big deal initially because they're very, very low numbers. But over time, those resistance genes build up in the parasite population. And then as we keep applying that selection pressure of using those products repeatedly, we keep moving that population more and more toward the resistant genetic types. And so we can get to a place like we are now with small ruminants, where we have some places where we don't have any products that are effective anymore because the parasites have developed resistance to them. So it's a genetic process that occurs over time where you have a few parasites that have a mutation that allow them to be resistant. And then as we continue over time, repeatedly applying those selection pressures by using those products over and over, we just select for those genetic types in the population, and they become the predominant type of parasite on the pasture, and then our products become less effective at that point.
And so the topic of refugia, I think, is probably a new one to most people. So explain a little bit about that. Our goal is not to wipe internal parasites off the face of the planet, because that's not possible.
Right.
We want to keep a few.
Yeah, no, well, I think we've always kind of thought, well, we'll just eliminate them with their products and go on, and we've used that approach for a lot of years, but we are realizing that it doesn't work. We never kill all of them. Now, the idea of refugia is that we want to slow down the development of those resistant genes in the population, or keep those resistant genes at a minimum in the population so they're more dilute in the population. So the way that we do that is choose some animals that we don't give a dewormer product to, so that we aren't selecting their parasites for resistance. And so they're continuing to shed non-resistant eggs on the pasture, and that keeps the resistance genes in the parasites more dilute on the pasture. So as other animals pick up those parasites, they're not only picking up resistant ones, they're picking up susceptible ones as well. And so if we do that over time, then we slow down that accumulation of resistance genes in the population to keep those genes more dilute, so it keeps our parasite population more susceptible as a whole to the products. We've known about that concept for a long time with sheep and goat production, and it's much easier to do in sheep and goat production than it is in cattle, because it's easy to recognize which animals are the most parasitized. And so what we are recommending now in sheep and goats is using the FAMACHA scoring system, which is where you evaluate the color of the inside of their eyelids, and if they're pink, they don't get dewormed. If they're pale, they do get dewormed.
Okay.
And if they're pale two or three times in a row, they should be culled. And because we know that some animals are just more susceptible to parasites than others. And we think about 80% of our parasite population lives in about 20% of the animals in a herd, just because of increased individual susceptibility to those parasites. And if we can identify those animals and get them out of the herd, then we've increased the genetic resistance of the animals to the parasites. And so then hopefully over time, we need less and less anthelminid product. But in cattle, refugia is a difficult concept because we don't have an easy way to recognize which animals are most affected
on the outside.
Looking at them on the outside. And we don't have a super fantastic way of doing it even with lab work, because the lab methods that we have a lot of variability. Not because of the lab method, but parasite egg shedding in the animal is highly variable. So they can have a bunch of parasites and shed a bunch of eggs today, and maybe next week they're not shedding so many. So it kind of depends on when we sample them as to whether we get a real accurate representation of what's going on there. The only way to really get super accurate parasite counts is to actually do worm counts, where an animal is necropsied and the stomach is opened and some poor grad student has to count the worms that are in that stomach. That's only used in a research setting. Obviously, it's not practical for real life. So we just don't have a great way to identify which animals need deworming the most in our cattle populations. So there's other ways that people have looked at trying to apply the concept of refugia in cattle. And some of those things are just picking a certain percentage that we're not going to treat. So maybe we're going to leave 10% untreated. Maybe we're going to leave the biggest, fastest growing calves untreated and treat the other ones. I think there's maybe some value in looking at the idea of not deworming adult cattle every year, because we know they develop immune resistance to the parasites, while we continue to deworm our young growing stock. There's some work in Europe has looked at what we'll call targeted selective treatment. So they'll use average daily gain as a threshold. So they'll weigh calves before they go out on pasture. They'll bring them in at some point, weigh them again, and then calculate their average daily gain. And if they're below a certain threshold, they'll deworm those and not the others. We can measure an enzyme called pepsinogen in blood, and it ostertagia causes an increase in pepsinogen in cattle. So we can get cattle in, get a blood sample, measure that, and then go back and deworm the ones that need it based on that. But none of those methods are very practical or applicable for our production systems here in the U.S. That's our big challenge, is we know refugia is important. We just don't know the best way to apply it effectively in our cattle populations yet. And so we're working on those things. People are working on those ideas to try to figure out what's the best way to do that.
So it sounds complicated. It's more than just don't worm 10%.
Well, I mean, that's a start. But what we don't know is how much effect does that have on the performance of those animals. So I think it's critical that we recognize that we're going to have to live with parasites. We need to maybe move away from the paradigm of absolutely maximizing animal production, animal growth, at the expense of parasite resistance. And so we may have to give a little on performance on some animals to try to maintain some of that refugia in the parasite population so that we can have effective products. I think an easy way to apply refugia is just not deworming adults, because most of them develop quite a bit of resistance. So we're not really worried about clinical disease in those cattle. And the data on whether there's value in deworming adult cows is a little bit questionable. There's not a lot of recent data on that. There are some older studies that show a benefit in improved weaning weight of calves if cows are dewormed, and that's presumably through increased milk production. There's also some work that shows increased reproductive efficiency if cows are dewormed. There's also some studies, though, that don't show a benefit, and so we don't really know where the truth lies in that. And those studies are 20 years old, and so they're done in a different environment than we're in now with parasites. And so we need some more recent work to look at whether or not we have significant production loss if we don't deworm adult cows.
In your mind, what is an effective level of control of a dewormer? So in our herd, if we use a product, what do we want? What level of control?
So the only way we have to measure that now is what we call a fecal egg count reduction test.
Okay.
It's by far not a perfect measure, but it's the only practical way we have to measure anthelmintic efficacy. The recommendation is a 90% reduction. So if we do a fecal egg count on a set of animals and then deworm those animals and then come back in 14 to 17 days and sample them again, we should see at least 90% reduction in that egg count to consider that product efficacious.
And if you don't see that, then you're assuming that there is resistance?
It's not like it didn't work at all. You know, maybe you got 80% reduction, but it's not. So there's some resistance there.
Right.
Maybe you got 20% reduction. In some cases, we've even seen the counts go higher. Mm-hmm. And that's not because the product is fertilizing the worms. It's just part of that variability in egg counts. It's really not meaningful to do fecal egg count reductions on one or two animals. It has to be on a group of animals so that we get because of the variability, it's not a meaningful test on very small numbers of animals. So we have to test a larger group of animals to account for some of that variability. But
So that's what you're doing with the project, the Parasites Resistance right. Project. You're working with some veterinarians, Dr. Biggs, and then some people from animal science. And we're actually doing this with herds all across the state to see what resistance we have.
Because we knew this was a problem in sheep and goats.
Mm-hmm.
And we suspected that it might be a problem in cattle, but there really wasn't any evidence for Oklahoma cattle. So there's a couple of published studies from other parts of the country that have demonstrated resistance in certain populations of cattle. So we know it exists, but there really wasn't much data on what is the concern in Oklahoma. And so we did a very small survey a couple summers ago where producers sampled calves, then dewormed them and sent the samples to us, and then went back and sampled them again 2 weeks later, and we just measured their fecal egg count reductions. We had 16 herds participate in that study, and 80% of those herds had evidence of resistance.
Wow.
So I knew there was going to be some. I had no expectations there was going to be that much. And we had herds from all parts of the state. We had all different major classes of anthelmintic products represented in that study. And so it wasn't like it was just one product didn't work or one part of the state had an issue. It was very widespread across the state. Mm-hmm. So that kind of opened our eyes, like, hey, maybe this is a bigger issue than what we thought it was, or at least we know it is an issue in Oklahoma when maybe we didn't think it was before. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of led us into the study that we're doing now, which is basically the same thing. It's just on a much larger scale to try to get a better overall view of what's going on.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what type of herds you're looking for?
It works the same way. So if a producer is interested in participating, they can contact us or contact their county extension agent, and they can get them connected with the right people. We'll send out all the materials needed for collection. Mm-hmm. So the only cost for the producer is the labor to put the animals, you know, through a chute. Typical recommendation is that we sample around 20 animals. Or if a herd is smaller than that, we sample the entire herd. If they've got 100 calves, we don't need to do all of those. If we can do 20 or 25, that should give us a representative sample. So what they would do is collect a fecal sample prior to giving an anthelmintic product. Then go ahead and treat that animal just like they would normally treat it.
With their own product, whatever
they normally use. Yeah, okay. We're not controlling the programs at all.
We're not buying their dewormer, but we're just taking the sample.
We're covering the sampling cost and the sample analysis, mm-hmm. but we're not changing their anthelmintic program at all.
Right.
We're just trying to assess the efficacy of what they're currently doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would take those samples, give the product like they normally would do, and then go back in 14 to 17 days and resample the same animals. It does need to be the same animals. Again, mm-hmm. because of the variability that we have in egg shedding, if we don't sample that same animals, it makes the data really difficult to interpret accurately.
Mm-hmm.
And so they go back and sample those same animals again. And these can be, in this study, it can be cows or calves. If a producer wants to do both, they can do both. They can sample their adult cows and weaning age calves or whatever the case mm-hmm. may be. And then they would just send those samples to us. The kit's really simple to use. All the instructions are there. There's package up samples and ship them to the address in the box. And then it'll take a few weeks and then we'll get the results back. And then once we get the results back, we'll analyze the results. And then I write a letter to each producer explaining the results and what the results mean for their herd. And then I don't give specific management recommendations mm-hmm. for their herd. I just encourage them based on the results to work with their local veterinarian as far as if any changes need to be made to the program.
It is a great project that's been set up, very simple. The only sticking point is we got to sample them two times.
Right.
You got to have them back, but an individual identification. But you're going to sample through the end of 2024, right? It's just for Oklahoma producers. Sorry, those listeners are from Kansas and Texas and all that. But I would say go to your local veterinarian and they can help you kind of do the same thing
for sure.
in your operation.
Yeah, and I think we're at a point in where we need to be moving that direction just as an industry, where we start measuring some parasitism levels prior to just blanket use of products.
Mm-hmm.
It is important, any veterinarian can do a fecal egg count reduction test in their clinic, but it is important that the methodology is very standardized. Again, because the variability in egg shedding, there's some variability introduced with the laboratory methodology, and so it needs to be done in a very consistent way to make sure we get as accurate and meaningful results as possible. It's very easy to send samples to the diagnostic lab, whatever state you're in. Mm-hmm. Any diagnostic lab can run those tests as well.
Ours do it here.
Ours does here in Stillwater. But any veterinarian can do it in their practice. It's not a difficult thing to do. It's a little bit time consuming to count the eggs and all those things. So some veterinarians may not have time to mess with that and would rather send the samples in. But it's not hard to do either way. But if it's going to be done in a practice, it just needs to make sure that we're doing it with the right consistent methodology mm-hmm. to get meaningful results.
I'll provide some context in the show notes, but your county extension educator, any area or state specialist, probably in animal science, understands that this is going on, the OSU Vet College. And we're trying to get at least 50 herds from across the state.
Yeah.
We're recording here in April, and we're kind of like gearing up to get some producers that are ready to work cattle this coming couple months.
We're just kind of getting into the time of year where we want to start thinking about administering products. And so encouraging a producer just the other day to, hey, before we just blanket treat them, let's see what's out there. Let's see what they have as far as parasite levels. And then if they've got significant levels, then we can see if the product works or not. The other challenge, one other challenge with the fecal egg count reduction test, they have to have an adequate number of parasite eggs present in the first sample to get a meaningful test. And that's some challenge that we've run into with a little bit with our first initial survey, but with this larger survey, that has become a pretty large challenge. And that many of the cattle groups that have submitted samples have very low parasite levels, which is good news for them that they're not, they don't have a big parasite issue at that time. Mm-hmm. But it prevents us from doing an effective assessment of anthelminic efficacy.
I mean, we're happy for them, right? But we would like to.
It doesn't help the project, but it's good information for the producer.
Yeah, so it's.
But I think the value in recognizing that in the study is that we could also use that. So if a producer is going to consider deworming, you know, 100 or 500 cows, go out and sample 20 or 30 of them. And if their parasite levels are very low, maybe you don't need to deworm them at that time.
Put that money back in your pocket.
Right. There's certainly some challenges with this because, again, we don't have a perfect way to measure parasite levels. Mm-hmm. And we have to make sure we interpret those egg count reduction tests accurately and perform the right way to get us to remove as much of the variability as we can. Mm-hmm. But it's the only option that we have currently to measure efficacy. So I think it's an important thing for producers to start thinking about doing.
Yeah. Just start thinking about it. So, Dr. Gillum, as we wrap up, producers just seek out information about this project if they're interested, and we'll connect you with where you need to go. Just look for OSU Extension or whatever, and we're really seeking lots of different types of cattle from what we've been encouraging producers to do. But as we wrap up, what are some best management practices, just some easy take homes for producers to think about when they're thinking about deworming? I'm sure you probably already said it, but just kind of some take-home thoughts, a few simple take-home thoughts about this.
Well, there's a couple things that can contribute to resistance that are not because of the parasite genetics. You know, we can't control that a lot other than trying to control like refugia like we talked about. Mm-hmm. Some kind of low-hanging fruit, so to speak, would be one is make sure we're dosing animals correctly. If you have the ability to weigh animals prior to dosing, then dose them according to the label directions based on their weight. I know a lot of producers don't have that ability, and so we're dosing animals based on estimated weights. If we're doing that, then dose the group of animals based on the largest animals in the group. If we dose to an average weight, then we're underdosing half the animals in the group. And if we are underdosing, then we're exposing those parasites to potentially a sublethal concentration of anthelminic, and that just further selects for resistance. The same reason we tell you producers to remove fly tags from cows in the fall, because even though the tag's not killing the flies anymore, it's still exposing them to low levels of the product, which promotes resistance. The same, very same idea.
Okay.
If we're not getting an adequate dose into the animals, then we're selecting for resistance. Think about what types of products we use in terms of the route of administration. The pour-on products are really popular, really convenient, easy to use, but they're also the most misused because if they're not applied like the label says, from the withers all the way down the top line, all the way to the tail head, we're not getting adequate dosing of that animal. If we put all of that dose of product, even if it's the right amount, if we put it all in one spot, it doesn't get exposed to as much body surface area of the animal, so they're not absorbing as much of that product. Injectable products have a little bit less concern with that because we're injecting the product. The oral products go directly to where the parasites are. And so sometimes we see a little bit better efficacy with those products. So whichever type of product you're going to use, make sure you're dosing it based on the label dose. If you're estimating weights, estimate high, dose to the high end of the group. I'm not very good at estimating weights, and so I figure out what I think they are, and I add a hundred pounds or 200 pounds to my estimate. Most of our anthelminic products are very safe. We don't have to worry about overdosing by a little bit, and so I add a little bit of weight to my estimated weight just to make sure I'm not underdosing them.
Okay.
And then just make sure we're applying products the right way, the way the label says, don't go out in the corral and squirt cows with pour on as they run by you in the corral. That's not an effective way to do it. It's quick and easy, but it's not effective, and it's just right. promoting resistance.
So. Yeah, if we're doing it, do it right.
Do it right.
Yeah,
because it's not only that the product's not going to be effective for what we're giving it for, but we're also selecting for resistance and potentially making the problem worse down the road.
And just to finalize this, the products we have are only the products we have. If like there are no new products.
Well, as far as we know, there are no new products on the horizon
right.
anywhere.
So if we lose the use of the ones we have, that's all we got.
Yeah, and in the small ruminant world, it's very common to have to use 3, maybe 4 products at the same time to get any kind of efficacy. We are using even some combination therapy in some herds now, some cattle herds now. There's some mm-hmm. value in using 2 different products of different classes in some herds with resistance. It increases the efficacy, but it also adds considerable expense. And so
right.
if we can avoid getting to that point where we have to do that industry-wide, it would certainly be right. to our advantage.
Well, thank you, Dr. Gillum. This is excellent information.
You're very welcome.
Listeners, consider the Parasite Resistance Project for your operation. I hope you take this information and chew on it a little bit, because there's a lot of information here, but I think it's really, in my opinion, gold for a local producer. Thanks again.
You're very welcome.
And listeners, thanks for tuning in, and have a wonderful day.